when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
This is The Guardian.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Today, we've got something special in your feed. Politics Weekly UK is introducing new episodes with Pippa Creera, The Guardian's political editor, and our political correspondent, Kieran Stacey. It will cut through the news from Westminster and bring you all the stories that you need to know to kickstart your week. Today's episode is a special chewing over of all the results from the local elections. The next episode will be on Monday the 13th of May, and new episodes will be out every Monday. And of course, you'll still be getting Politics Weekly UK with John Harris every Thursday. Now, over to Pippa and Kieran.
We've had in York and North Yorkshire, true blue Tory territory.
We know there's a recount, so we know either that Andy Street has won, or that he has nearly won.
We are trailing up against Labour, led by Keir Starmer, who has the charisma of a peanut.
This isn't an episode of The Wire. This is real life.
You could say I'm a happy man today. I'm as happy as inside Keir Starmer is unhappy.
I'm Pippa Creera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
Pippa, you're looking very smart, if I can say that, for a bank holiday Sunday. You've just been on the TV, right?
I have. I've been doing Laura Koonsberg's BBC Sunday morning show. And one of the beauties of doing it is you get to do makeup and hair first. Obviously, clearly, it's about the high-level politics.
Absolutely.
That's what it's all about. Yeah. But an added bonus is being able to arrive here afterwards with my a nice little curl in my hair and my eyeliner done professionally.
Oh, I thought you'd just done it for us.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry.
It was interesting because you were there in the room. Suella Braverman was there. Mark Harper speaking for the government. Paul Scully, more from the left of the party. What was your reading of the room kind of 2 days after those elections?
Yeah, well, I mean, it obviously was a big moment that we'll be poring over. And what I thought was really interesting about those three in particular is that they represent different bits of the Conservative Party. And we had Mark Harper looking actually pretty drained, pretty exhausted. He has a reputation for always having a spring in his step and being able to sort of, you know, find a silver lining in anything. But he was struggling today and looked, you know, actually quite fed up. He's obviously the transport secretary and on the government payroll, so paid to take the line. And then you had Paul Scully sitting next to me on the panel, who is a backbench MP, former minister, who's standing down at the next election and therefore feels, I think, probably a bit liberated in what he can say. And he represents the sort of one nation centrist moderate wing of the Conservative Party. And he was openly fed up and saying he doesn't expect the Conservatives to win the next election and he's not sure whether it's possible for Sunak to pull back. And then, of course, and we can get into this more later, there was Suella Braverman, the former Home Secretary, who was there, it seemed to me, to once again put a political grenade under everything.
She can't help it.
She can't help it.
She is astonishing. I mean, for her message today was supposed to be, I've got the a copy of the Sunday Telegraph in front of me, and it starts like this. Let me cut to the chase so no one wastes time overanalyzing this. We must not change our leader. So she said she doesn't want to oust Sunak. Then she goes on the nation's biggest Sunday politics show and says, oh, I wish I hadn't voted for him as leader. If this is backing him, what does opposing him look like?
I know. And then also said, you know, I've been speaking to colleagues privately, including some in government, and they feel the same, that Sunak's in a hole, so he needs to keep digging. You know, it was
an amazing quote.
It wasn't the most supportive. So anyway, those three represented the sort of three strands of the Conservative Party at the moment, and none came across as really very hopeful about their prospects, and all illustrated just how divided the Conservative Party is. And that's really one of their biggest problems, that people look at them and think they're more concerned about themselves and their own fates than about
Do you think that's what Braverman's intervention today is about? Is this just stage one of her leadership campaign for after the election?
Yeah, she was incredibly composed and glossy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she had a sharp suit on, her killer heels, and knew exactly what she wanted to say. So for me, it felt very much like her putting a hand in the air and saying, remember, everyone, I'm here. I'm here. Yeah. When the moment comes, I'm ready. I'm ready to step into the breach.
She's good at that. All right. So just quickly, before we get into the detail, we've had almost all councils, all areas of the country now declare. The big picture is the Tories have lost about 473 seats. Labour have gained 185. The Lib Dems have gained 104. Very good night for the Lib Dems. They actually won more seats than the Tories at this round of local elections. The Greens have gained 74. Others have totaled to 285. That gives us a national estimated vote share. Were these votes repeated across the country at a general election, according to the polling experts Rawlings and Thresher, of Labour at 35%. So that's quite a bit down on where they are in the polls at the moment. The Tories on 26%, up on where they look like in the national polls. The Lib Dems on 16% and others on 22%. Now, whether others really win 22% of the vote at the general election, I very much doubt. So we can talk about that a bit. But also, of course, we've had a series of other votes. We've had a series of mayoral elections where the Tories did manage to hang on in Tees Valley. Ben Houchen won that. That was a very important moment for Rishi Sunak, as we'll talk about in a bit. But they lost West Midlands, very marginal race where Andy Street really hoped he would hold on and didn't. Labour won a string of other mayorals, including, of course, Sadiq Khan in London, who did better than a lot of Labour people feared he might just before the results came out. And then we had the Blackpool South by-election, which was the first one to declare, so people could be forgiven for forgetting it, but actually maybe tells us the most about where the electorate is right now. Labour absolutely stormed to victory in Blackpool South. They got the third biggest swing in post-war history, 26%, and the Tory vote was obviously far below what it had been last time that seat came up.
I think we know that the national polling picture that we're seeing is pretty accurate, because even though the vote share you explained there doesn't quite tally with the national picture, that's because these are local elections. And it's pretty difficult to read across directly from how people vote in locals to how people vote in national elections. And part of that is because the sort of impulse to vote locally is about issues which are in your area. So maybe you've got a particular concern about potholes, or there's a planning application you don't like, or whatever it might be. And part of it is because people make different choices at local elections. And I think we saw that reflected in the number of people that voted for independents and smaller parties. Whereas if you go into a general election and you see it as your only opportunity of changing government, then you might be more prepared to vote tactically. We've seen that at lots of the by-elections over the last year, that people can see where they need to place their vote in order to, in this instance, get rid of the Tories, even if they're a Labour voter, but being prepared to vote Lib Dem and vice versa. And I think we're more likely to see that at the general election than we ever would at a local. But overall, the picture that you just set out is a pretty dismal one for the Conservatives. It suggests that they're on course for heavy losses. And of course, you can't forget the fact that the Conservative Party relies very heavily on its for its ground operation, its door knocking, its leafleting on local councillors. And it's lost hundreds more, meaning that there'll be that little bit harder come a general election to, you know, to get the vote out on the ground. The other thing that we're seeing happening is that even if all the numbers don't necessarily stack up, the geography is working for Labour and the votes are in the right places. So we see them, for example, winning back votes in some of the areas that they lost in 2019, including the West Midlands, including the East Midlands, including in Tees Valley. We see them, for example, winning back votes in places that voted for Brexit, some of the Essex council seats that they picked up again. We see them as well in their own strongholds, like, for example, London, votes stacking up, but crucially also in Tory areas. And the most striking example of this to me wasn't just the East Midlands and West Midlands mayoralties, it was the new mayoralty of York and North Yorkshire, which is, of course, Rishi Sunak's own backyard. His Richmond constituency is one of the seats within that mayoralty. And then the one other I'll just mention is the council of Rushmore in Hampshire, which has been Tory for 24 years, which Labour won enough seats to take control of. And, of course, is just down the road from Aldershot, which is the headquarters of the British military. So, you know, all playing into Keir Starmer's patriotic Britain narrative. And so Labour are getting votes, you know, right across the country. And I think they'll take huge sucker from that, even if, you know, some of the races actually ended up being quite close.
Yeah, well, let me pick up on two seats that or two places that stuck out for me, which fit exactly the narrative you're talking about. One is the Blackpool South by-election. Now, this is obviously a leave voting part of the country. These are exactly the kind of seats that Labour has been targeting over the last few months. And when progressive Labour voters get very frustrated with Keir Starmer, especially on things like, you know, not saying that Labour would get closer to the EU if in power, this is the reason Labour is taking the position it does. Because if it doesn't, the calculation is among Keir Starmer's people, they don't win in places like Blackpool South. And those are places that voted heavily for Boris Johnson not that long ago. So, and the other one that stood out for me was Hartlepool. Now, Hartlepool, if you remember, was that by-election in 2021 where Labour lost it and went backwards to the governing party. Boris Johnson actually managed to increase the Tory majority there. And it was such a catastrophic result that Keir Starmer considered resigning as Labour leader afterwards. And it was that moment, apparently, which then changed his entire strategy to lean more heavily into the, you know, into chasing the, exactly those kinds of voters. And it's paying dividends. They, Labour have taken control of the Hartlepool Council. So in exactly the places they're targeting, they are winning.
And I think we should look a little bit more closely at Tees Valley and the West Midlands, because of course the thing about those two mayoralties and Ben Howson in Tees Valley and Andy Street in the West Midlands, both the Conservative candidates, is that they were the two races that were identified by Downing Street and CCHQ as being particularly significant, because if they managed to hold on to them, they felt that that helped with the narrative of Sunak actually having a plan and being able to sort of get back on the front foot and not necessarily heading towards certain defeat. Now that worked to a certain extent in the Tees Valley. And of course, it should be noted, and as you reported last week, both of those individuals very much ran on their own name and didn't have Conservative Party branding on their their leaflets. And I was rather bemused to see when Ben Howson won his race and then went up to give his acceptance speech, he wasn't wearing his Tory blue rosette.
He forgot it.
I know, terrible, really. I know. He would have wanted to obviously have you know, praised the Prime Minister and the party, I'm sure. But the interesting thing about Tees Valley is that despite that huge personal vote, and despite the fact that he still won, there was a swing of about 16%, just over 16% towards Labour. And that means that those constituencies, five constituencies in the area, including places like Hartlepool that you've mentioned, but also Darlington and Redcar, which went Tory last time, they would swing back to the Labour Party. And it's those sorts of seats which obviously are the difference between a Labour government and a Conservative government. And then on the West Midlands, we had that really nail-biting finish on Saturday, where the Conservatives ended up asking for a recount. They ended up having a recount in Coventry, one of the seven local authority areas that make up the West Midlands, and bundle counts in the other areas. And in the end, it came down to just over 1,000 votes between Richard Parker, the Labour candidate who won, and Andy Street. And Andy Street had absolutely run as an independent in that one. You know, generally it was quite well respected and quite well liked in the region, but even that wasn't enough to sort of hold the anti-Tory feeling at bay. And then to step back from it all for a bit. So there's the two seats that we were sort of spun that, you know, they would hang on to. They were going to be difficult battles, but you know, Sunak was going to win them, and then that would mean that he could be on the front foot going forward. They lost one of them, right? So that's really damaging to their narrative.
Well, I actually see it in a slightly different way, which is one thing I've noticed over the last few election cycles. The one thing the Tories have been better at than Labour is expectation management. So I went for lunch with a very senior, a member of the cabinet, just at the kind of beginning of the campaign. And they said to me then, I think we're going to lose both Tees Valley and West Midlands. And that is, you know, we're really worried about those.
Did you believe them though, Kieran?
I did think that Andy Street was in trouble. I just couldn't see how Ben Houchin would have lost.
Because he won with 73% of the vote last time.
73% of the vote. You don't lose from that position. Mm. But it was striking. And they did successfully make those, as you were saying, they successfully made those two things the mark of success or failure. And in a way, Rishi Sunak's opponents within his party also bought into that because they also started saying, well, if he loses both of those, that's when we mount our coup, this fabled coup that hasn't happened and doesn't look like it'll happen. And then, of course, they did hang on in Tees Valley. So that I think, actually was a smart bit of expectations management in an otherwise catastrophic night. Mm-hmm. Rishi Sunak's now gone out and said, oh, it's very mixed results because they won that one that they probably we're never going to lose.
Yeah, and there's big stories elsewhere, of course, than the mayoralties. I mean, I was very struck by the East Midlands race. It was a new mayoralty, which Labour picked up for the first time. Again, that has got lots of seats that Labour would need to win back that they lost in 2019. But let's talk about London. I interviewed Sadiq Khan last week and we were chatting about his chances. And I said to him, look, Labour, London is a Labour city. You're going to walk it. You know, you'll get a big majority. There's a Conservative government. And he was actually quite nervous. Yeah. And it took a little bit of time for me to work out that it wasn't just him putting it on, talking about expectation management. Yeah. But actually, he was concerned about turnout and whether people would come out and vote in the right places because it was the third time he was running to be London mayor. And he said to me, look, you know, you say that London is a Labour city. Well, people used to say that Scotland was a Labour country, and we all know what happened there. Yeah. And he recalled how in 2008, Ken Livingstone's team running against Boris Johnson then reassured him that there was absolutely no way Boris Johnson would win in London. And then, of course, he did. So he was quite nervous about it. And then we had this really bizarre spectacle on Friday night when the votes had all been submitted and verified, but the counting hadn't actually started in the London race, where these rumours started emanating. Yeah. I mean, I spoke to people, senior Tories in the London campaign and at CCHQ, who said, we have won the race. I was kind of like, how can you know?
Yeah.
Yes, you might be in the room for some of the verifications, but you don't have enough people on the ground to be able to get a proper picture. And B, just because turnout is high in boroughs like, you know, two blue boroughs like Bromley and Bexley, doesn't mean they're all going to vote for Susan Hall. Yeah. And of course, as it turned out, that was scaremongering or mischief making, or maybe it was incompetence. But whatever the reasons, we then saw Sadiq Khan go on to win, and not just win, but win by a bigger proportion than he has done either of the other two times he's run for Mayor of London.
I think, you know, to cut those Tory briefers a little bit of slack, the same message was coming from Labour, right? So I was talking to someone very close to Sadiq on the Friday, and they were saying, we're really worried. You know, we think we've won, but these turnout numbers are just not what we were expecting. So I think that was a genuine thing. There's a lot of kind of slightly pompous commentary I notice around today saying, oh, how could Westminster journalists fall for that spin on the Friday when clearly the Tories were never going to win. I think the Tories and Labour both thought that that was going to be much, much closer than anyone expected. And it was, let's be honest, closer than the polls were suggesting. It wasn't a 20 percentage point lead. For me, the big takeaway from that is, can London please start counting their votes sooner than that? Because we can't tolerate a gap of that long. Don't put us through it again.
Absolutely. So before we go any further, Kieran, I was doing my prep for this podcast and I was reading some articles.
Obviously,
very diligent, always do my homework. And I came across this article, which I wanted to read to you, this excerpt from it. Now, it's about, and it quotes and is about a politician. I'm not going to read the politician's name. I'm going to say X instead. And I want you to see if you can guess who it is.
Okay.
X called this week's election results disappointing, but not fatal. I think we're going to win the general election, X said. We'll face some hard decisions when we get there, but we'll deal with them. A slow but steady improvement in Britain's economy is one achievement X emphasises, but that may not be enough to turn the tide for the Conservatives. Analysts say the local elections are not as much votes of confidence for the Labour Party as they are votes against the Conservatives and the way they run the country. X said that the low turnout meant many traditional Conservatives had stayed at home as a protest. But X predicted they would return at a general election when improved economic conditions would be more apparent to voters. Who do you think X is, Kieran?
Right, okay, so X is clearly a Tory. That message sounds very familiar, but I reckon I know who this is. Is it John Major?
It is. Yeah. It's John Major right. in 1996, just after a catastrophic set of local election results right. for the Conservatives. And of course, the year ahead of the 1997 general election.
Yeah, at which the Tories won, right?
Well, yes, absolutely. It all came to go. They stuck to the plan,
Kieran. They stuck to the plan. The plan was working.
The plan delivered. Absolutely. And 1997, the rest is history.
Well, okay, so that is the Tory playbook right now, right? So Mark Harper, you were saying, was on Laura Koonsberg's show with you. I've been speaking to senior allies of Rishi Sunak. And that's the line. The plan is working. Stick with the plan. I guess to a certain extent, it seems to me that line has got them through the weekend. We were wondering whether these election results would then trigger this coup that we keep hearing about from the backbenches. But, you know, as I was saying earlier, Suella Braverman's now in the papers and on broadcast today saying we need to back Sunak, albeit in her own inimitable way. And others seem to be saying to me saying the same thing. And it was very striking to me that on Friday morning, so really very early on in all this election counting, Andrea Jenkins, who was one of the most, I think she was probably the first backbencher to say, right, I want Sunak out. And I've delivered a letter saying that. She was on the Today programme on BBC at 8 o'clock in the morning, basically saying, well, we've got to stick with him now. We're not going to bring him down. And I wonder whether, is that really because the Tories managed to win Tees Valley when some people thought they might have lost? Or was this ever actually a thing? You know, did they really have the numbers? Did they really have a candidate to put forward? Do you think this coup was ever something to be taken seriously?
I have my suspicions, Kieran, and I think actually it benefited all of those leadership hopefuls for there to be a big question mark about Sunak's leadership and whether he could hang on.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I don't think that they had the numbers to get enough letters in to trigger a confidence vote. They certainly wouldn't have had the numbers to win a confidence vote, although that in itself would have been incredibly destabilising for Sunak. And they couldn't coalesce around an individual candidate. I mean, we had Penny Mordaunt, we had Grant Shapps, we had Suella Braverman, we had Kemi Badenoch, all have been cited in the media and by Tory MPs in recent weeks and months having their eye on the prize. But I think ultimately this jostling, and seeing Suella Braverman on the telly this morning confirmed this for me, is about what happens after the general election, after a presumed Tory loss, and at a point where they are then fighting over the future of the Conservative Party.
The thing that I don't quite understand, though, is if that is your calculation, okay, we've got to stick with this guy, and we might not like him, but, you know, he's what we have, and we're not going to be able to bring him down. Surely you go in, you know, absolutely full-blooded. You don't hedge your bets with your backing of him. This is your only option. You want to presumably minimise the losses at the election so that you have something of a party, a parliamentary party afterwards. Why have we got, you know, Suella Braverman saying, oh, I back him, but I regret voting for him in the Tory leadership campaign? And it just seems they almost can't help themselves. They have to stick the boot in, even while admitting they're not going to get rid of him.
I think it's exactly the point. They can't help themselves. And I think after 14 years, the Conservative Party has become totally unmanageable.
Right.
And it's been unmanageable for a while. It's not because of Sunak, it's in spite of him. And he's finding it hard to keep them together. And, you know, I think he's got a stay of political execution until the general election. You know, they've concluded that even though they're very unhappy with his leadership, and some like Suella Braverman are saying openly that they are, lots more are saying privately, they recognise that changing leader again this side of an election will be political electoral suicide for them. So they won't do it. But it's going to be a bumpy few months between now and the election, because not only do you have some of these sort of leadership hopefuls using the time between now and the election to try and effectively make their pitch to the Tory membership and to Tory MPs. You also have backbenchers who are more focused on trying to get out support in their local constituencies and therefore potentially taking the Andy Street Ben Howshan approach of appearing a bit more independent and not being afraid to slag off the leadership. And you have various ministers who are stepping down to do that and who feel sort of liberated to say what they think. So I think even amongst Tory MPs that are generally of the more sort of loyal vein, you're going to hear a lot more people speaking out. And that's going to be a constant problem for the Tories when they need their party to be disciplined and stick rigidly to the message. They're going to struggle with it.
And this all makes me think, this one thought has just occurred to me in the last few weeks, which is, I can't imagine a Tory party conference this year. Because if you have Tory party conference this year, that's going to be a beauty parade of people, you know, like Suella Braverman, like Kemi Badenoch, everybody, basically, anybody senior in the party, trying to take attention away from the Prime Minister and, you know, probably making very right-wing, certainly someone like Suella Braverman will be making very right-wing messages to appeal to that base of support, completely detracting from the general election that's about to happen, presumably, by that point. So I just wonder whether we don't have conferences this year and we end up with a late October election.
Yeah, but then can Sunak see ground corners enough to predict that that's just what is going to happen? His record suggests not. And the most damaging thing about that beauty parade of potential future leadership candidates at a Tory conference would be that all the eyes of the media are on the parties during the elections. They get more broadcast time than any other time during the year. And what everyone will see day after day after day will be Tory infighting, Tory jostling, Tory internal politics, and not thinking about and looking at solutions for some of the major problems our country faces, whether it's our public services, whether it's our economy. You'll get Sunak and the Tory leadership trying to talk about that, but all of the oxygen will be sucked out of it, and the focus will be on more Tory infighting. And that electorally is really bad for them.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, all right, so that's the kind of case for why he's not getting things right. But let's put the case for Sunak's defence. The strategy here is, as you mentioned in that quote that you had earlier from John Major, let the economic recovery take hold. Inflation is falling. We should expect GDP numbers to pick back up a little bit. And one thing that I think we'll start to hear more about, especially after those projected national vote share statistics that I was talking about earlier. I was talking to senior Conservative last night, who's talking a lot about that and saying, oh, hung parliament. We're in hung parliament territory. And that means you've got to start looking at the Lib Dem manifesto and, you know, watch what the Greens will do and watch what the SNP will do. And this, of course, is a rerun of the playbook for 2015, which did work. You know, they managed to defeat Labour in that year by, well, those posters of Ed Miliband in Nicola Sturgeon's pocket. That will, I think, be a big part of the message for the next few months. Vote Labour, you'll get a coalition of chaos with all these assorted fringe elements from the left.
But then you look at what's happened in British politics since 2015, and any attempts by the Conservatives to suggest that other parties might be more chaotic than they've been over the last 5 years, I think will fall on deaf ears. You know, Sunak is definitely going to try and push the economic argument. He's going to hope that people feel better off by the time of an election, with, as you say, inflation down and interest rates falling, and maybe even another mini budget with some more national insurance cuts. His problem is, I think, that economic pain is already baked in.
Right.
People are already suffering. That is not a quick position to recover from. And the story on public services are also pretty grim. People can't get an appointment at their GP. Their trains aren't running properly. There's this feeling that, you know, Britain isn't working. And so I think that the problem for Sunak is, even if he is sticking with his plan, and I think they're right to identify the economy as a key issue, if not the key issue, at the general election, I think any attempts to kind of distract with, oh, you know, you're going to get a coalition, or Labour are going to be in charge, or, you know, whatever else arguments they come out with, I think they're going to really struggle, because people just aren't listening to them anymore.
Yeah, I think that's right. And actually, the moment at which I think voters turned off was that period where Liz Truss was in office in the mini budget. And once you, as the Conservatives, completely surrender your reputation for both competence and, you know, economic stewardship, there's really no way back.
With the backdrop, of course, of already surrendering any reputation that they had for, you know, standards and integrity with the whole Boris Johnson drama.
Right. Okay, so we think the voters aren't really listening to the Tories. Maybe there's, you know, limited way back for Sunak. But are people listening to Labour? And, you know, I wonder what we should read into these local election results for Keir Starmer's party. They obviously, as we were saying, did very well in areas they targeted, in Leave voting areas that Labour had previously been strong in, but then lost in 2019. There were, however, some signs of losing some of those progressive voters and losing in areas where there are a lot of Muslim voters as well. I mean, we saw in Oldham, very unexpectedly, Labour lost control of that council after seeing several of their councillors defect and several independent candidates voted. Now, of course, this is the Gaza effect. This is, you know, a lot of people telling Keir Starmer they're not happy with the line that he's taken on what is happening in the Middle East. Labour will say, we're not too worried about that because we're winning the voters we need to win. But it was interesting to me that John McTurnan, who's quite a kind of thoughtful,
former Blair advisor at Number 10.
So not of the left, but he's been out all weekend saying, we really need to watch these voters. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Do they need to Do they need to worry about their left flank, or are they okay?
So I always take the example of some of the big inner London seats like Tottenham and Hackney and so on, where they've got majorities of about 40,000. And they can afford, really, frankly, to lose, you know, 5,000 votes to the Greens or to independents, whatever, because the majorities are there. There are some seats, and we've done a bit of work on this, and they're quite a small number. You're looking at like half a dozen to a dozen seats where the difference in Labour losing votes to Greens or independents could end up meaning that the seat stays with the Tories rather than being won back by Labour. So some of the marginal constituencies in the Red Wall, for example.
Some of those northwestern seats especially.
Yeah, but then where I think it is significant is in Scotland, where the centre of political gravity is slightly to the left. There is a sort of a big progressive vote, particularly in parts of the Central Belt and all around Glasgow. You know, these are seats. This could be the difference between 12 and 24 seats currently in Scotland that Starmer needs to win back, which will not necessarily be the route to power, but certainly will help make that route easier and could be the difference between a small majority and a big enough one to be able to do what he actually wants. So I think it's something that they do need to have their eye on. And you heard that a bit over the last few days with people like Pat McFadden and his deputy Ellie Reeves talking about how they need to reassure Muslim voters that that they can trust them and that they're on their side, and try and explain a bit better about where they are now on their position with Gaza, rather than the very clunky position they started off with some really unforced errors from Starmer.
Okay, so Labour might have a problem with progressive voters, as you were saying, in places like that Central Belt in Scotland. Tories clearly have a bit of a problem with reform, even if they didn't perform quite as well as their national polling level suggests. That is a big problem for the Tories, the threat on their right flank and this looming presence of Nigel Farage on the wings, waiting to come in. Will he come and campaign for that party or not? I know lots of Tories are desperately hoping that he stays away and that he goes and does spots on Fox News and gets paid highly.
Hangs out with Donald Trump instead.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's all from us. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this special episode. If you did, please make sure you like and follow Politics Weekly UK. Our regular episodes will start on Monday, 13th of May. Every Monday, we're going to be bringing you stories from inside Westminster, as well as looking at the issues that are going to be dominating the week. John Harris will be back with Politics Weekly UK on Thursday. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
This is The Guardian.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.